I'm your host, King Tech. Today, I'll be talking to Devine Diggs about growing up in Staten Island and his role in managing the Wu-Tang Clan. He's not only RZA's older brother, but he's also the manager, the all-in, the guy that runs Wu-Tang behind the scenes. I always tell people that Sway and I are like the yin and yang. You're about to hear the yin and yang side of the Wu-Tang Clan, man, with the RZA and his brother Devine. Catch up with the show on Hulu anytime. Let's get into it right now, man. Right now, I'm sitting with another legend. This is podcast number 8. This is Devine, a.k.a. RZA's older brother, correct? Not younger brother.
Older brother.
Older brother. And it's an honor, first of all, to have you here, man. You're one of the hardest guys in a weird way to get a hold of. Not that you didn't want to do an interview, but ever since Mike's and, man, everybody's like, man, who is Devine? What was his role? Because, you know, that was the first time that you were kind of exposed on what you did, right? Mm-hmm. They kind of broke down what your role was, which was, I thought the documentary was great leading into Wu-Tang and American Saga. Right. And I just told Sway, I was like, man, I'm interviewing Devine today. And he was like, damn, I want to get him. You know what I'm saying? He was like, man, because after you watch the series, man, it's like the first time. It's like, you know, we've all known about RZA. And through the years, I've known him for 20-something years now, and your name keeps popping up. He's like, yeah, talk to Devine. You want to get, you know, I wanted some jacket from Live Nation. You're like, call Devine. I'm like, man, what does Devine exactly do now exactly for the crew? You know, so, but in the series, I'm going to go back a little bit. Mm-hmm. It seemed like he always came to you as, I don't want to say father figure, man, but the wiser, older brother. That's the feeling we get when we watch the series, that you were giving him a lot of jewels as he was growing up. Is that correct? Were you the?
I would say yes. You know, being an older brother, you look after your younger siblings. That's just a natural thing to do.
Right.
And it was never hard. He's a very bright, intelligent young man. I think for me, I just gave him the stern answer. Like, you don't have to think about this more than once. And after a while, you know, I think he realized that my answers was just answers of just being straightforward and not being, you know, trying to be compromising what we had to do. So I think that relationship me and him had always just was a shared understanding. And we just had to always figure out what to do. And he'll look to me and I'd be like, we're doing this. And he used to look mm-hmm. around to his friends. He'd say, nah, I'm not going to question. So
right.
And that's what started out, the grown-up side of us. But from a kid's standpoint, you know, mommy leave rules and regulations, I'm enforcing them.
Right, right.
You know, simple as that.
Now, in the series, we see you come in and you talk to your mom and you're like, we got the house.
Right.
So were you, without, you know, I mean, this is, I'm, you know, I know y'all made millions since then. We talking about, what, 25-some years ago now, right? Mm-hmm. Were you always the guy that kind of brought the money to the table for the house? Like, were you the provider? Like, I'm guessing your father left at some point and you felt like, I'm taking on this role for the family.
You know, my mother had a way of communicating.
Okay.
And sometimes you saw it with tears. Mm. And that made you realize that either you're going to come to your mother's aid or you're going to sit there and be victimized by the circumstances. So whenever a little odd job I did, whether it was before hustling, it was just selling newspapers or just right. working at the convenience store, packing bags.
Right.
There was a sense of coming home and putting the money on the table.
Mm.
She didn't have to ask for it. There right. was that genuine respect to say, hey, mommy, had a good day, and lay it on the table.
Right.
And of course, as we got older, she's like, she did it the mafia style. Come in, what you got? And she took a commission from you.
Right.
But in the younger years, yes, it was that I got to step up, you know. And I wasn't alone in real life. You know, I had other siblings there to help out, and we did it as a family. And my mother was just brilliant in the way that she described our unity.
Right.
That a house full of kids, we grew up with the understanding that it's only one loaf of bread. Mm. Feed your younger brothers first. And that's what you see that character portraying. He's portraying when you in the scene where I think when Bobby comes in, he's showing him the place, and he's like, "You got the basement. You always wanted your own room, and it's bigger than mine."
Right.
That was a older sibling doing what a father would do if he was present.
Right.
But my father did leave a strong impact of morals and values that stood with me regardless of his absence.
Right. So at what age did you have to kind of get into the street hustling side of it? Was it in high school, after high school? And did you feel like that was, at that time, the only way to get the type of money you needed to keep the family going?
Well, in the beginning, it was always doing little odd jobs. You just watching and admiring the older guys who's actually doing it.
Right.
You might be that dude, hold this bag. You ain't know what was in the bag. You know what I mean? You just took the walk, you know what I mean?
Right.
And later on, they kept giving you $20 and they kept giving you $30. But one day I was like, yo, what's in the bag?
What's in the bag, son?
You know what I mean?
Right.
And you know, in the early days, there were great dudes, Chili Wob, Tone, Lazard, those type of dudes from Brownsville, Brooklyn, that would protect us.
Why Brooklyn?
Because Brooklyn was like the inspiration about characters to me. I grew up Brownsville.
So the show takes place in Staten Island. So break that down.
Listen, you know, because Staten Island is where we grew up, mm-hmm. but we honed our skills in Brownsville.
Mm.
And of course, when you come back from North Carolina, what you see in the show, my first stop is Brownsville. It ain't Staten Island yet.
Right.
And I'm way younger. This is like 9 years old. Right. But like I said, in Brownsville, you will carry the bag.
Right.
10 years old.
Right.
In Staten Island, we didn't get really familiar and get strong with the streets until 14, 15, 16. And by 17 and 18, we was there. But no, the part of learning from what the older guys was doing, that's when I began to see and put things together. Because I always followed the older guys. So what you'll see me coming to Staten Island later, and when, like I said, when I got about maybe 12, 13, I was familiar and consistent because my grandmother lived there. My mother was in Brooklyn.
Right.
So we went back and forth. I was the one that we went back and forth, bottom line. And in the long run, Staten Island became the home. And mommy eventually settled all of us there.
Right.
And that's why you see that, you know, when Raekwon and RZA's talking about how far they go back, they're in elementary school.
Mm.
You know what I mean? But me, I'm the other kid. I'm all over the place.
Right.
You know what I mean? I'm not in elementary school. I'm over here. I'm over there. Right. So in the long run, I'm saying is that we just begin to realize that in the streets, you got to step up.
Right.
So at 14, Verrazano Bridge, selling newspapers, all these things happened that made me count money quicker than an average kid would be counting it. And that led to 15, 16, I'm counting $10,000.
I got
10 G's in front of me. Unheard of.
Right.
So coming home to my mother, she looking at me 15, 16, boy, what the hell? What you doing? And I hid that from her out of respect.
Right.
And to a point, of course, I couldn't hide it no more.
Yeah, when you got locked up, In the show, you have to call home and say, hey.
That's grown. That's like 18.
18.
So 17, 18.
Did they try to throw the book at you, man? Were they trying to get you for like 5-10 years? Or was it like a slap on the wrist type thing?
Oh, it was 8 to 24.
8 to 24?
8 to 24. Because in the show, you only see one incident. It was multiple.
Oh, so when you say multiple, you mean they stacked it up together?
Run it concurrent.
Oh.
That jailhouse shit, right?
Yeah. So are you lucky? Did you get lucky to get? Did you have people fighting for you? I mean, it seemed like, at least in the show, it felt like the world wasn't the same without you, and your soldiers were still going to bat for you and collecting and trying to make ends meet. And it's beautiful how it all came together and where we are today. But share some of the hard times when you was locked up with us.
Well, you know, when you first get locked up, you don't have no clue of what you just did, even why you were being arrested. It's kind of oblivious to the fact that you're committing crimes every day, but you think it's normal. So upon my first arrest, I was baffled. Like, what the fuck am I doing? Okay, sorry.
It's XM, brother.
I was like, what am I doing here? Like, what happened? You know, my mother's gonna kill me, basically. And you get out. Because the first one is a slap on the wrist. You get released on your own economy, you go out, come back to your next court date, but it doesn't stop you
right.
because you don't have the penalty thrown at you.
Okay.
So when you see on the show, that's when you see the time when it was real, because now I'm not carrying a few dollars worth of stuff.
Right.
I'm moving it.
Right.
And that's what you saw in the show. You saw the part where that's enough to get you 8 to 24, because then you're moving bombs. You're bagging up bricks.
Right.
And that's not petty any longer. That could be, in some cases, people would say, you know, that's a conspiracy charge.
Mm.
You know what I mean? Because you got multiple workers. Mm. And then back then, you know, it was a traumatizing experience, but it was one that made me sharper, let's put it that way. And when I had to make that call home to mommy, it was like, she's going to fucking kill me.
Right.
Because she warned me. She said, a hard head, make a soft ass.
Right.
And you're going to learn the hard way, boy. And I was like, I got to take care of the family.
Right.
And when I realized it, it was like, yeah, like I said, 8 to 24. And it was like, wow, mommy, I fucked up. And I had a lot of people around me. Mm-hmm. I had people that I don't mention anymore, because people have got their families now and no one talks about the past as much. And I was blessed to have people in the system that works for the system that saw me different. They didn't see me as the guy standing there as a drug dealer.
Mm-hmm.
They was like, we always believed in you. We don't know how you got yourself in this predicament,
mm-hmm.
but we're going to help you do everything to avoid a criminal lifestyle.
Mm-hmm.
I may have been branded,
right,
but it's not a lifestyle.
Right.
And that's the blessing that came from those people that I don't mention.
Right.
But RZA's desire to become a producer and an artist was the release from all the confusion about what am I really going to do? Because after that street altercation, you really got to tell yourself,
what's next? Yeah, what is next?
You're a felon, dude. You're screwed.
Right.
You can't get a government job. You can't run for borough president. You can't be mayor, senator, congressman.
Nothing.
You're basically screwed. And I always remember what my Uncle Hollis and my Uncle Euless used to tell us when we were young. It was like always just making sure that we understood what was the right path and the wrong path. And I think in a short way of saying it, God was warning me. So when I got that smack on the wrist and it was like you see in the show, you know, I'm not sending you to jail. The judge was very lenient that day on me. I can actually tell you what he said to me. I was standing there. You know, you got to stand up.
Right.
He just looked at me, said, approach the bench.
To you?
He looked at me, approach the bench. I approached the bench. He said, today's your lucky fucking day.
Oh, man.
And when he said that, I just looked at him, and I turned around. That same look you see the character giving my mother.
Yeah.
I turned around and gave that look like, thank you. Because it was coming from up above. It was something else that was driving the conclusion of my life. I had no real clue, but I knew that something was intervening.
Right.
Some people like to say it was divine intervention.
Pun intended. Yeah. So now I'm saying the empire that you guys have built, let's go back in time. You come out and RZA's telling you, hey, man, I really want to produce. I really want to make something out of myself. He's in the kitchen. He's kind of having that conversation with you like, hey, I want to call moms and say, I made something of myself.
Mm-hmm.
Were you convinced at that point that this rap thing was real? Or were you still doubtful that y'all made probably like $50 million over the past 25 years with Wu-Tang. This is probably the number one selling album of all time with all the artists you guys have had and the dynasty you've built. Were you a believer out the gate, or did it take something for it to happen? Or can you tell us that story a little bit?
You know what? I was always a believer, but it was a hobby. We did it for fun.
Right.
So even when you see the character, he's trying to tell you that it ain't real. It's for fun.
Yeah.
But I always believed. Although the show portrays me as a hard ass to my brother, that equipment didn't pop out of nowhere.
Right. So you were supportive from the beginning.
From the beginning.
Gotcha.
You know,
gotcha.
We're speaking about reality. I don't want to interrupt the flow of the show, but in reality, of course. It's my little brother right there. I have the same ambitions and the same desires that he have. And that was our release. Like, we would go in that basement and be in there for hours. Mm. You know, I was the DJ at first, and he was just rapping.
Right.
And, of course, my time came more to the street. But I was always a believer, not only in him, but in what we were trying to achieve entertainment-wise. We're having fun. So you got to remember, this is not your job.
Right.
This is a hobby you're doing when you come home from school. Right. You know, when you get a little summer youth money,
right.
You know, you go out and buy a little drum machines. Back then, it was a little push button one.
Right,
so
we
we had a straight arm.
Right.
So it wasn't really, really official until the street game came in. And that's when I really, really gave him my undivided attention about helping him. But there was one hump that we couldn't get over. And the SB-1200 is like that symbol. That,
yeah,
you know?
The jewel of hip-hop history.
Yeah, so, and that I didn't buy him. I didn't buy it because I was too wrapped up in trying to get that break.
Right. Yeah.
And I was telling myself, well, after that, whatever. But for now,
right.
You got to wait. And, you know, as the story unfolds, even with the series, that's like a true scenario where if I would have knew better, I would have did it immediately.
Mm.
But I didn't know better. I was wrapped up in being who I was. I was trying to think that it was my contributions that is keeping and maintaining the lights and keeping mommy from worrying. But I always believed in what he was doing. I always believed in what we could become. And I guess the time that I fully, fully realized it is like you see in the next episode, you see, you know, you'll see me standing there looking around like, mm-hmm. Yo, shit is unfolding.
Mm-hmm.
And how is this shit happening? And what's the components? Like, how does it happen? Like, you know, normally I'm used to go buy something, bag it up,
right.
Go out in the street so I know the process.
Right.
I'm in an environment where I don't know the process.
Right.
I don't know how this shit is unfolding. Like, oh, hold on. How we get here? This is nice, but who did all this shit?
Yeah, you said in episode 8, actually, it says, you know, you said you got your name in lights, bro. Like, you made it. And I think RZA made sure that this was in there. He looks back at you and goes, nah, bro, we made it.
Right.
So I think that... in his mind, and I'm, you know, getting to know him over the years, Sway and I are very, very alike. It wasn't about one of us succeeding.
Mm-hmm.
It was about the yin and yang. Okay, if you can do this, I'm going to handle this. And I kind of see you guys as this yin and yang thing because he had, you know, I had invited you to the house like 4 or 5 years ago, and we were having this conversation. And I didn't really know your role at that point. And mm-hmm. you started telling me, like, look, man, I'm the street dude that was running the streets and getting mm-hmm. the money. And I was like, oh, really? So because nobody really knew. And I think that's beautiful how you played your role in the back.
Mm-hmm.
But the checks got to go through you. I know that for a fact.
Right.
That's how it works.
Right.
The guy in the back, there's an upfront guy
mm-hmm.
that the public sees. And then there's a guy, that's the Sway and Tech story right there. So, and we were talking about, I was like, yo, man, so how does RZA deal with all these, and you deal with all the pressure of this internal beef, external beef, this thing happens, that thing, and you just, the way you broke down the RZA thing to me was so dope. You were like, look, Tech, if somebody steps in our shoes 3 times, most men would literally just start fighting. Like, hey, man, bro, please stop.
Mm-hmm.
Round 2, some people do it out of the gate. You know, like, hey, man, you stepped on my Jordans, whack!
Right.
That's kind of how your personality is, pretty much like mine. But you said RZA, you can step on his shoes the 3rd time, he'll just take his foot out of that shoe, put in another one, and keep going.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a hell of an ally to have on your team, man, when you got a person that thinks like that.
Right.
And I think even you as an older brother have to go, that's a weapon I got that nobody else got right there.
Right. Because,
you know what I'm saying?
Definitely. You know, first, you know, Peggy, you and Sway have influenced us heavily. Let me just go back and say thank you for your contributions and all that, because I wouldn't even been able to sit with you. And, you know, when I did sit with you, I was like, nah, I idolized you guys. Like, these guys are the dudes that's been rocking for years in
thank
front
you.
Of us. We've done yeah. our thing, but you guys...
We did our thing.
You think, dude, yeah, you we, did your yeah, thing okay. first.
yeah.
Okay?
Yeah.
And so when me and you was having that conversation, I felt comfortable. We had hung out, you know, a few times with Richard.
Right.
Of course, like I said, I watched you guys from afar. I'll be out there in the room looking while RZA's in here having these conversations with you
yeah,
guys.
Yeah.
And
as a matter of fact, at one point, Sway and I went on vacation and gave you guys our station and our radio show for a week or two.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll never forget that. We had never done that. And it was just like this. And it wasn't like we were so close that I just felt like, you know what, man? RZA and what you guys represented was as hip-hop as it got. This is like, we're talking like 98, 99, where we left and left DJ Revolution. Y'all just came up, had a good time, mm-hmm. hanged out. Because I knew you guys represent hip-hop the way we're trying to do it.
Right.
I mean, that's, you know what I mean? So hip-hop to us, it was a way out of, you know, the hood in a sense, but it became like a religion. Now we loved it. Now we were like, everything had to be like correct.
Right.
We want this, that, like, the way it is now, Divine, it don't feel the same at all. Right?
Yeah.
It don't feel the same.
No.
The struggles is not the same. And, you know, if I interviewed a cat right now and I said, hey, so we're going to do a life story on you, man. You got 3 hit records out. This is a true story. I'm not going to tell you what label or what big company told me this story, but this is.
Mm-hmm.
So they're sitting with a guy, 3 hit records out. Man, we really like where you're going, and tell us your background. You know, how did you so the hustlers help you out? Did you know you hit the block? Did you do, you know, what neighborhood dances? What did you do? And the guy goes, literally, my mom got me a laptop. I downloaded a couple of beats, and I put it out. Which is great for him because, mm-hmm. you know, he got a couple of hit records. Now he's making money or whatever, mm-hmm. man. But there's no story. There's nothing to do. A documentary on.
Right.
The documentary would have been like 2 minutes.
Yeah.
Like mom at Best Buy, laptop.
Where's the struggle, right?
Where's the struggle? Well, what y'all went through, not only was it real and 100%, but you brought on other dudes that were struggling, which is a whole different thing. That's like you on a boat that you could barely survive on, and you're like, bro. You can get on too.
There's more people in the water. Keep pulling them in.
Keep pulling them in.
Yeah.
And at some point, you know what happens with the Titanic? They have to start pushing the boats away because they're like, yo, you about to flip us over, man.
Exactly. And you know, like I said, you guys did such a great job and you're continually doing it. And I think that's what me and RZA continue to try to do. I try to stay in my lane.
Right.
Like, you know, we've seen each other for years. And I stay in my lane because when you go back to the point where you were saying how, you know, fortunate I am to have a brother with that kind of vibe,
right.
You know,
because
if it was up to me, you know, Wu-Tang Clan ain't nothing to fuck with. We going to set it and be. And he was like, yo, fine. You don't got to do that no more. You know, we got soldiers. Don't get it twisted. But that's not where we are. That's not the energy. And when I used to get really upset about how things was going, he'll be like, I said, like you said earlier, he'll be like, he'll take his foot out and leave it.
Leave the shoe?
And leave the shoe right there.
like,
and I'm like, yo, them shits are $600. The fuck you talking about?
Yeah.
You know, we had the toothbrush back in the days. Grab them. But
yeah.
My point of it is that he never cleansed on to a problem.
Mm.
And my nature has always been, no, I ain't letting it go until I solve it.
Right.
And it has to be the way that we want it. And he was always very adamant about, yo, look, man, let that rock. So when you look at new artists today who don't have the same background as we have.
Mm-hmm.
I can't take nothing away from whatever their struggle is.
Right.
But I know that my struggle was complicated. And it had to be the Heavenly Father watching over us because even in the show, you see, we've lost great men.
Mm.
These men that you see in dying were 10 times smarter than me, but not as diverse as I was. Like, I know when to shut the fuck up.
Right.
And you see in the character, he when he gets challenged, he knows how to bow down. But you know what? I'm gonna let this big man. All right, big man, whatever you say. You know, he knew how to, I knew how to do that. And a lot of those brothers who we lost, they were more energetic. You know, even in the show when we lose Hayes,
right?
You know, that character should have never swung on a cop, despite his military background. That kind of person, if he was alive today, he'll be sitting right next to me because he was that intelligent. That foresight was in most of us, but how do you execute it? So a lot of hip-hop artists today is doing it because they can see a long list of examples.
Mm-hmm.
So they eat the culture instead of, you know, birthing the culture.
Right.
They eat it and they digest it and they become successful. We were the ones who had to bite it, spit most of it out because it wasn't nourishing and nourish and keep the only good part of it. And what I mean by that is that, you know, we have to remember that challenges is there for growth. You know, you're always going to have opinions. You're going to always have situations. But the show is really telling you about America and its struggle to do right, not only by itself, but by its citizens, its people as a whole. And what you see us doing is trying to make it out and not have to find a new criminal way to survive. And for my character, you see him almost, he feels a little insulted because he can see a big brother don't like the fact that he got to let his little brother take over.
Mm.
But he's wise enough to know that his little brother's capable.
And talented.
Yeah, and extremely talented.
Yeah.
And he knows that.
Right.
But that's that side of him, like, and you know, in the real world, when he was younger, I used to look at Riz like, fuck, you figure that out.
Right.
And I used to say to myself, that's my Michael.
That's Godfather.
That's my Michael.
Right.
I never liked Fredo's role. I didn't want to be Santino.
Right.
That's my Michael. I didn't feel stepped over. I felt honored. And I do to this very day.
Right.
I feel honored that, you know, my brother is continually fulfilling his dreams. And I'm fortunate enough to have not only that we're brothers, but I invested in that dream. And whatever happened throughout all these years of Wu-Tang, I've never made the dream about me.
Right.
My goal and my job was to protect his interests at all costs.
And it's a fact, brother, because until the documentary came out on Showtime and this series on Hulu, nobody really knew exactly your role. We just kept, your name pops up here and there, but it's a beautiful thing that is come up, man. And you're saying some incredible things right now that I'm sure the fans want to know, man. Going back to North Carolina, what impact did North Carolina have on you guys? Because when I think of New York dudes, I don't think of North Carolina. I think of like, you know, the mentality of, you know, like you said, street dudes. What did y'all exactly get out of North Carolina? Now, did you go with him? Were you there? Not there? Did you visit? Not, and Uncle Hollis, was he a father figure? Because I asked RZA this, and he said, yeah, he was. He kind of was. Break that down a little bit.
First of all, Uncle Hollis is my mother's uncle. That's his brother's daughter. But he passed away.
Mm.
So it shows you the integrity of this man. Here's a woman with all these kids and not being able to survive. So he took the burden off of her. And he brought us down there, and we learned values that Brooklyn or Staten Island could never teach us. You know what I mean?
And how so?
Oh, well, the first thing is, you see even in my character when I got down there, you know, I'm a wild street kid. I ain't trying to hear nothing. Work. You must be out your mind.
Right.
I ain't working no fucking tobacco field.
Yeah, they slavery time.
Yeah. That's what? What? It's hot out here. What are you talking about?
Right.
You know, so, but he had a way. He had a way about him. Now, my Aunt Goldie, as you see in the story, whip ass. She ain't play.
Mm.
But Uncle Hollis gave you wisdom. So when I got down there, I gravitated towards his calmness and his ability to speak without anger or aggression. And I was angry and I was aggressive. So I'm now being taught to think not once, not twice, but three times before I open my mouth. And that kind of taught me how to calm down and observe, due to knowledge. You know what I mean? Instead of always speaking so quick, due to knowledge. So between Uncle Hollis and his brother, Uncle Euless,
right,
that's who we model ourselves after. Uncle Hollis was the doctor. You know, he was the surgeon. When I was young, I was cross-eyed. This man did surgery, tightened up my muscles. Eventually, the muscles, as you get older, you know, shit happens and they go back. But my point of it is that man was so wise and so skillful as a doctor himself.
Right.
He would come home. And when he came home, you know, first thing he would do was tend to our minds to make sure that whatever the pressure we was going through because of our mother and father breaking up, he was able to bring us and consult us. And during the day, when he was doing his job as a doctor, we was on the farm with our Uncle Euless and our Aunt Goldie. Now, Uncle Euless was stern, but he was a wise stern man. He was the one who said, "Come, you coming with me?" Because after Aunt Goldie got tired of me,
right,
I had to go with the man.
Right.
And now I'm out there driving a tractor. Now I'm out there, you know, 5:30 in the morning, feeding the chickens, the goats, the pigs, everything, you know, and then having to take a drive. We had 600 acres. So now you got to get on the tractor, and that's a drive if you don't know about it.
600 acres. I don't think, yeah. How many miles is that, man?
I don't even remember how many miles, but you know, 600 acres ain't small. Right. You know, my hood ain't no more than 15 acres.
Yeah, exactly.
So my point of it is, those two men inspired us, and I think me and RZA took their roles. He became Dr. Hollis Porter, and I became Uncle Ulysses. And I think that's what we modeled ourselves after, two brothers. One, of course, Uncle Goldie took care of the households, but Uncle Ulysses took care of the farm and all the workers. So now you understand my role. So right. Now I'm sitting there, and when it comes to Wu-Tang, I'm Uncle Ulysses. My job is to oversee the 600 acres. My job is to make sure all the workers are showing up and doing what they got to do and watching over the empire.
Right.
But he was invisible. Nobody knew Uncle Ulysses but us. Like, they people knew him, but
right.
He wasn't the guy everybody talked about.
Right.
Uncle Hollis was that guy. And I think Uncle Hollis gave us that jewel. And when we came back to New York, I think me and RZA never forgot that. And that's what we emulated.
So does that help you in your business and your creative mind and the way you've kind of ran Wu-Tang Clan? I mean, from what I understand, man, explain your role a little bit, man, because it's not very clear to this day exactly. RZA does the music. There's Wu-Tang Productions. Mm-hmm. There's Wu-Tang Records. There's mm-hmm. Wu-Tang gear. I know for a fact, like, we saw you guys in the late 90s, man. I think it was like, y'all were selling like 40 million in just Wu merchandise. Mm-hmm. And it was mm-hmm. like, it's an empire.
Yeah.
What is your role exactly from back then till now?
Well, I would always say my role was to carry out the word. RZA will come in. He'll be brainstorming. And he'll be like, yo, we should do this. We got to do this. We got to do that. But nobody knew how to do it. Nobody knew what to do.
Right.
And I think the part that he always trusted me is that Divine heard me. And if right. he heard me, I'm going to find out something tomorrow about what I said.
Right.
So, of course, after we started Wu-Tang Production, he was like, yo, we got to have a record label. We have to have this. So I was just went in, you know, incorporated Wu-Tang Records, incorporated Wu-Tang Management, incorporated 36 Chambers Studio, and then became real close with my legal team. But in the street side of it, I can be honest with all of you, I want to let y'all know, I had really good people. I had a person named Martin Filler who schooled me on protecting my assets.
Now, was he corporate or street corporate?
Well, he was a lawyer. He was corporate, okay? And I have another gentleman by the Mr. Leibowitz. I'm not going to get into him, but he was a Jewish guy who told me that I can be tough with my mind just as quick as I can be tough with my fists. And he just told me, hey, what's happening? And I think this is probably like 91.
Right.
And we're doing our demos. But I don't know what my role is. I'm like, what the fuck am I doing? Like,
right.
What role would I play in this?
Right.
And he says, every talent has a manager. And every manager has a business association. So you have to associate yourself with all the businesses that makes the music industry functions. And before I knew it, I was up at BMG Publishing.
Mm.
I was up at BMG Record, which is RCA, who was our label.
Right.
And when RZA was in there talking to Steve Rifkin, I was down the hall talking to Rich Isaacson. See what I'm saying?
Gotcha.
Same way when we signed Meth, and, you know, Meth may be down there having this conversation with Kevin Lowes, but I was sitting there talking to Leo.
Mm.
You know, same thing when we went to Sylvia. You know, RZA and them down there talking to Dante Ross, I'm over here having a conversation with Sylvia. So the role that I played, I think, was how does it work?
Right.
And because everybody was trying to be the talent and the producer, I was like figuring out, well, what's the best deal? How do you make the best deal? It's like buying a brick. Do you sell it as weight? It moves fast, but you don't get enough profit. But if you bag it up, you can make four times the price.
Right.
So RZA trusted that thought in me, and I think that what I did over the years is that I incorporated every company you hear about Wu-Tang.
Right.
I did everybody's deals.
Damn.
I did all the deals.
So what was the first deal that came after 36 Chambers?
I think the first deal we closed after 36 Chambers, was it Meth's or Dirty's? I get confused a long time ago too.
Right.
But I think
Meth went to Def Jam.
Right, Meth went to Def Jam.
Dirty went to Elektra.
To Elektra, exactly. Okay.
Deck went to Rifkin.
Deck stayed at Loud.
At Loud. Who else?
And then And then
GZA went to.
We gave GZA to Wendy Goldstein, which was Geffen.
Geffen, yep.
And then after that, we started. I started thinking.
Oh, Ghostface, wait a minute.
No, right. I started thinking.
I was like, wait a minute, okay.
And RZA was like, we need to do something different. And it was a knock on the door. Ron Sweeney called. And Ron Sweeney.
Who's Ron Sweeney?
Ron Sweeney was a big time lawyer who took a job at Sony and became the president of Epic.
Okay.
And he made a call to us, and he came to Staten Island. He sat down in a restaurant with us and enjoyed a nice meal at one of my friends, you know, a West Indian spot.
Okay.
And he was like, I'm going to make y'all guys a shitload of money.
Okay.
Some of me at Rhythms just looked at each other, well, we're making money, but a shitload of money.
That sounds better.
Sounds a lot better than what we was making. But we was making a lot then, but point I'm making is that we started Razor Sharp Records then.
That's right.
When we signed Ghostface. And then later, Capadonna came home.
Right.
We signed Capadonna, and it just kept going. And, you know, we just kept going. We started a publishing company and said, hey, you know, RZA, Ray.
Where was Ray signed to? Ray was
on Loud.
Loud, yeah, that's
Ray was
right.
on Loud. So basically, Steve decided to keep. RZA, the history of everybody knows that we gave Steve first right of refusal.
Okay.
Which means that he had to match the number. Or let us take the artist somewhere else. So at that point, when he had Deck, he had Raekwon, he had Wu-Tang Clan.
Okay.
And the rest we just mentioned.
Right.
So Ghost was still available, Cap was still available, RZA was still available. And what we ended up doing was we just said, well, of course, we let RZA go to G-Street because he wanted to do the Gravedigger thing. Right.
Was that Prince Paul or who was that?
Yeah, Prince Paul. Come on. Props, Paul. Come on. Yeah. He was the man back then.
Yeah, he was the man. Yeah.
So props to him. And so what I was doing was I was just making sure I carried out his dream. So the next day he'll wake up and he'll be like, you incorporated Razor Sharp?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, you Wu-Tang Management is set up? Yeah, we got an office over here. Wu-Tang Publishing is set up? Yeah. And we started Diggs Family to sign everybody else who didn't get signed. Mm. So I end up signing a publishing deal with 70% of the group.
Right.
And I think that's what people remember me for when the guys get angry. They'll say, yo, man, the fuck, you got my publishing.
Right.
I don't got nothing. I'm your partner.
Right.
I'm no different than Universal Publishing. I'm no different than anybody else.
Right.
I'm your partner. And so I think what RZA allowed me to do was be comfortable enough to find my own lane. And my lane was, I like being with the accountants. I like being with the lawyers. I like being up at the label. I like sitting with the marketing team and hearing everything and writing everything down and then going back and then creating another entity of Wu.
Right.
So even when it got to Wu-Wear, it was like me and Powell sat down one day, and Powell, in respect to him, you know, he's been my friend, partner, since we was kids.
Right.
And
now, did you bump in the show? Is Power your friend out the gate, or y'all become friends?
We were friends first.
Okay.
But we had an altercation, and that altercation is what you see in the show.
Right.
As the show unfolds, it shows you that we had relations. Me, him, Hayes, we all used to roll together.
Right.
And Ray and
Now, what was the altercation about? Jealousy? Was it about bread? What was it about?
Well, for me, I think back then, if I can remember the story correctly, you know, we always getting too egotistic. We started getting cocky with each other, bro. You know, you gotta understand, you 17 years old, got 100 G's. Nigga, you don't know how to act, basically. You know what I mean?
Right.
And like you see in the show, me and Bobby have certain kind of characteristics about ourselves. And I'm like, wait a minute, are you crazy? I slept at that dude's house.
Right.
His mother knows my mother. There ain't no going to war, because you're not gonna get away with that one.
Right.
And when we had our argument, you know, it was like, you go your way, I'll go mine. And when we chose not to be violent is when we found, I would like to say, a second chance to redeem our friendship. Because some people can't get over when you do violence. It's like, it's tough.
Right.
But because me and Power resolved it nonviolent, when I returned back home, I was able to go to Ghost. I was able to go to RZA. I was able to go to Power and Ray and everybody in the hood and be like, whatever we did yesterday is over with. my brother got a way that we're going to make more money than we ever did. And the best thing about it, we ain't never got to fight each other again.
Mm.
And when everybody, they look like, nigga, that shit don't sound real because that don't happen in the hood.
Right.
There's always an altercation, but
yeah.
I knew it wouldn't get violent. It can get egotistic, like I said.
Right.
So when me and Power started getting our egos was rubbing, we departed, and that departure caused me to be a soldier again. Because you know, in the story where you say, I do it myself, that was not, no, you'll never do it yourself.
Right.
You're too important to take the risk because you're the, you know, you're the, you know, you're the head of everything. You
right.
know, you're that, you know, you're that Rex.
Right.
You know what I mean? And, but when I took that leap of faith, I guess fate had another plan for all of us. And from that moment, I knew that me and P was going to be all right. And going back to once that happened and we started Wu-Tang, he was one of my first associates that I went back to, like, love you, nigga. Love you, too. All right, so but forget about what happened.
Right. I need this much.
Yeah, we need to do this.
And right.
I got this already, but I need you to do this because I can't go back on the block.
Right.
Because if I get caught again, I ain't coming home.
Now, did he have to put up some bread in order to get Wu-Tang rolling? Because it felt like when you watched the documentary, he jumped in and all the, he was getting immediate respect from other Wu-Tang members. And I figured that had to do with him, is that because, you know, like you said, Sway and Tech, the Wu-Tang story is similar to a lot of people everybody was going through in the late 80s, early 90s.
Mm-hmm.
We always had a street homie that was like, hey, I can't put 100 G's away in a shoebox every week. I got to do something with it.
Mm-hmm.
Now, did he invest in the group at that point? Did he come to you? Because you didn't need him technically. You know, you're the brother.
Right.
Your brother has the talent, and you have all the MCs. Why go back to him?
You know, you got to tell yourself, right? You walk into a room, somebody hooked up the microphone, somebody scheduled us to be here. You can't do everything. And respect goes a long way when you're trying to gather a group of men that can easily be swayed left or right.
Right.
Power had the other side. You know, he had Ray's influence. He had Park Hill dude's influence. Of course, I'm from Park Hill and Stapleton and New Brighton, so I can go anywhere on Staten Island in all reality. But in the show, you see me choosing Stapleton. And I knew that Stapleton beef was beefing with Park Hill, according to our story, because of me and Power.
Mm.
And the only way to resolve that is to bring me and Power back together. And then you've seen all of us come back together because you think about it, the Klan is from where? Park Hill. Most of them is from Park Hill.
Right.
You got Dirty and Jizz of Brooklyn. You got, you know, Ghost and RZA and me. Right. We're living in Stapleton at the time.
Right.
So we merged our influence. And when I went to Power, you know, the funniest story is like, no, we cool? Yeah. No, I want you to be a partner with me. Yeah. Okay, and open up the door and let him walk in the room with RZA. And I closed the door and I didn't go in there because I knew that our egos will still come up.
That's
normal. It's two Dons sitting in the room.
Right.
One got to bow down to the other one. And it's like, I don't think we're going to do that.
Right.
Who's the nucleus in the room? The Abbot.
Right.
Who's the one that can balance, like I said, take his foot out the shoe and put his feet in another one? And that's what when I closed the door and walked away, I didn't ask how much was given. I didn't ask what they did. He came out the room. He gave me the nod. We gave each other a fucking hug. And it's been legendary ever since.
The one thing that I do want to ask, because one of the most, I had you got on the show and I said, I said, what's your highest high for Wu and the lowest low? And he said, immediately, the lowest low, easy, instantly in his head, ODB passing away.
I'll concur.
Yeah. What was that feeling like when he comes out of jail or wherever he was being held up? I don't even know what it was. And all of a sudden, I think Dame Dash got involved, and they were trying to sign him, but he's really related to you guys.
Mm-hmm.
And at that point, man, if I'm not mistaken, again, he's not only signed to you guys, but he's a cousin, right? He's a family member.
Yeah. It's my grandmother's brother's son, my great cousin.
So you being technically still the street cat and the corporate cat in the crew, probably didn't enjoy somebody else from another company coming in and offering bread to ODB. And I still to this day don't understand. Is it that they were offering him more money or he wanted to do things his way? Because when I watched it again recently and I still didn't understand what was happening. Is it that he was convinced that he could do bigger and better things outside of Wu-Tang? Or was it that, what was it in your opinion?
For
do
me,
you remember what I'm talking about?
Yeah, okay, I remember. I mean, I remember even getting a phone call. I've talked to him for weeks before he had came home. And we had an understanding because I was there before he was. And I'm telling him, like, yo, when you come home, you're going to need some time to readjust yourself.
Right.
And he didn't understand what I meant by that. You know, even in the story, in the series, you see me telling my sister Cherie, you know, when a man comes home, he's trying to catch up, you know.
Right, I remember and, in the kitchen.
Yeah, yep. And he's trying to catch up, you know. And you can see that I'm not objecting to the father returning home from jail to see his son because any son would want to see his father.
Right.
So in Dirty's case, I was trying to get him to embrace the family first, not the industry. We wanted to take him to Wu Mountain, where we got 60 acres on a mountaintop.
That's Ohio?
Yes.
Okay.
And we wanted to detox him. We wanted to have him have fresh water from the well. And if you wanted meat, you can go hunt deer if you want. You can go hunt wild turkey if you want. You know, it was just letting go of what was what I consider to be a mental hell. Because when you locked up, you in some shit.
Right.
So he had outside influence, and always will give honor and respect to my Aunt Cherie. I don't care what happens. I honor and respect her first and foremost. And she had, I think the kid name was Jared, and they were just trying to make moves. And when he came home, I was supposed to meet him. I went to the bank, got like $10,000-$20,000. Cause that's not, you know, that's how Dirty was, you know.
He
put that cash in my hand. Right, nigga, let me see the money when I get home.
Right.
And I told him this would be money to just go see your family and your kids, have a good time with them for a few days. You know, when you come home, you want to take care of your family, and then take you and the Wiz go, and y'all just you and your family, you, your woman, and your kids, and go take some 90 days by yourselves.
Right.
And he came home to a fucking freak show to me, you know? And me and Dame was cool then, and we cool now. So it's no, it was never like, to me, when I talked to Dame, I was like, yo, Dame, chill, what are you doing? And he was like, yo, they came to me. And me and RZA sat down at some little small restaurant in the city with him. And it was like, yo, and RZA kept giving me that look, don't fucking say nothing, Devon. Because, you know, I'm like, I'm ready to say, yo, Dame, check this out, nigga. It ain't about no fucking money, nigga, because you know my money long, nigga. I know your money long, my money long. So
right.
It ain't about that. It's about taking advantage of a person who may not be in his right mind.
Right.
And we need to clean him up before we put him in front of a fucking camera.
Right.
And it didn't work for me. I became that guy. If you watch his documentary, he's on the phone. They tried to change my last name to Briggs, but he was talking to me.
Oh, shit, that was you.
That was me he was on the phone talking to while he was sitting in the studio.
When he was saying, what was he saying?
He was saying basically, what's $10,000? What's this? What's that? He was basically just cursing me the fuck out.
Right.
And he was doing that because he still wanted me to come and keep everything that we had said prior to him getting out a reality only in the financial side, not in the side of going to clean up.
Right.
Not going back to the streets, because if anybody knows, you know, I grew up smoking weed and drinking. Soon you get home, the first stupid thing you seem to want to do is get high. And I didn't want to see that happen to him. So in the long story short, I became the bad guy. I told my Aunt Cherie I didn't think this was cool. I cursed out his manager. I told Dame how I felt in a respectful way. I never cursed at nobody. I don't do that. I just tell him, yo, he needs reforming. You know, I'm a product of being reformed.
Right.
I could tell you I've been reformed. So I don't say that as a negative sense. I say that as, okay, I think clearly now. And I can see where, if I make a bad decision, I know where it's going to take me. I can almost catch myself. Mm-hmm. So I tried to do that with him. And for the moments of losing him, you know, it was the night we did the Jersey concert, if I can remember correctly. We was in New Jersey. I think the whole Klan was at Continental Arena, and he didn't show up. And he was doing the show somewhere else. I don't know if it was Detroit or Denver. I can't remember where. And he didn't show up that night. And when he returned, finally, he came to the studio, but nobody knew he was under the influence. Nobody knew he was going in the bathroom, and nobody knew that he was consuming. And, you know, we lost him that day. And for me, it was almost like a domino effect. Because when you lose your mother, you lose your crew, you're losing your family members, something's telling you something. God is telling us, are we all on the right path? Are we loving him or are we loving Satan? What is it that we love so much that we don't do the right thing for each other?
Mm.
And I felt like I had failed that day. That day when I left him in the studio, and I was so angry that I got in my car and went home. No, I wasn't supposed to go home. I was supposed to stay there and be that person that when he looked at me, he always tried to clean
straighten up.
He'll straighten up a little bit. And I was disappointed that night, and I acted out on myself and left. And when I got the call, I just fell on the floor and I just started crying like, damn, God, that's the second time I did that. So nowadays you try to tell yourself, are we here to entertain you with foolishness? Or do we as men and women have a duty to try to clean our lives up? And I think when you're watching this show, you're seeing people trying to change. You're seeing people trying to say that, yo, enough is enough of this image of us being stupid and ignorant and never being refined, because we are refined people. We are an intelligent people. But we keep letting our image portray our reality, and the images is falsified. You know what I mean?
Right.
So when me and Dirty used to kick it like that, he always knew. You know, it's like you see in this show, his character was just, like, man, get the fuck out of here with that righteous shit.
Right.
But he's righteous, though.
Right.
He's the best person you can meet. I mean, this dude was loving, caring, but when he wanted to have fun, he had fun. And I sometimes miss that because sometimes I don't know how to have fun. So for me, you know, losing Dirty was traumatic. It changed the game for all of us. I'm sure you, God, can relate to that feeling. I'm sure that all the Klan members felt the same.
Yeah.
But, you know, we just had to keep going, of course. But have we made the alterations to our perspective? Have we really changed? And I think that's the goal of what RZA's doing with this series. He's reminding all of us where we came from so we can look at our reality and stop acting like we did it by ourselves.
Wow, man. Well, there it is, man. We're talking to Preacher Divine right now, man. If there was a studio audience, everybody be in tears on the floor right now. Handkerchiefs will be getting passed around. Very knowledgeable, man. One of the greatest human beings I've met. Always real. Man, it's a pleasure having you. This is a ridiculous podcast series, man. Oh, my God. Every guest we've had is like doper than the last one. I'm like, yo, gee. Well, congratulations to you and RZA, man.
Thank
you. The Wu series is amazing. Wu-Tang and American Saga on Hulu right now, man. And I'm going to come over there and shake your hand and say peace, brother.
Thank you, guys. Appreciate it.